Well, as Norton said in the welcome, this is the second week. We're continuing our series called Money Crazy. We're talking about money and possessions. If you weren't here last week, thank you for not bolting for the door when he said we were going to talk about money today. If you were here last week, thanks for coming back, knowing we were going to talk about money again today and for the next 2 weeks. So if you weren't here last week, I acknowledged this at the beginning, but I'll do it again. It's weird for us. It's a little awkward, or maybe makes us a little anxious to talk about money in church, but it's really important that we press through that for a number of reasons. The first is that the Bible talks a lot about money. Our faith has a lot to say about money. Jesus talked more about money than almost anything else. And the reason that that's true is because money's really central to all of our lives. It's something we have to deal with and think about, and we often worry about every single day. But this time that we live is also a really weird time to be alive and to be in America. As I shared last week, we are one of the richest nations in the world. And all of us here today, by world standards, are rich. We're wealthy, even though it doesn't always feel that way. And despite all of our wealth, we continue to have a society, a culture, an economy that's driven on consumption, buying more, accumulating more, new experiences, new stuff. And that's just driving us in a lot of situations to make some really bad financial decisions. And we've just passed $1 trillion in credit card debt. And at the same time, I had some conversations after the service last week and in between. There's also a dark side of this prosperity, this time of great prosperity that I didn't talk about last week. And that is that it seems like there's a lot of inequity as it relates to this wealth in our country, doesn't it? It seems like the top gets richer, the rich continue to get richer, and the middle's getting hollowed out, and the bottom just keeps getting bigger. I think 1% of our world's wealth, of our country's wealth, is now concentrated. The top 1% owns over 50% of the total amount of wealth. 1% of the people own 50% of the wealth in this country. So it just feels like there's the haves and the have-nots, and that's getting worse. And a lot of us are struggling to find work that's meaningful, that produces enough for us to be able to live. And so there's that frustration as well. And yet, it's still the reality that the poorest among us are still rich by world's standards. If you go to the website that I talked about last week, globalrichlist.com, it'll tell you where you rank on the world's richest people. Even if you make minimum wage, $7.25 an hour, and you work full-time, you're the top 9% of the wealthiest people in the world. That's not to say that that's easy or that it's easy to live in that kind of situation, that financial reality here in this country, but the reality is that we are all wealthy in this country. But it doesn't feel that way, and that sometimes leads us to making some crazy decisions. We lose perspective about really what we've been given and what it's for. And last week, we began by looking at a story from Jesus where he laid down his foundational perspective about money. And it's this: if you weren't here last week, the foundational perspective that Jesus had about money is that the conception that we have, that we own what we have, that when we get money, it's for us, that when we get possessions, they're for us, is actually a myth. We're all just renting everything. We're all just sort of borrowing it. God owns everything, and he entrusts it to us to use as we see fit. We can either do wise things with it, or we can do foolish things with it. That's the concept of stewardship, not ownership. We're all just managers or stewards of the money and the possessions that we've been given. And to illustrate that, last week, the homework was I actually gave out money. If you weren't here last week, you picked a bad week to skip church. Just a reminder, you never know what's going to happen when you come to church. We actually gave out money in envelopes because we wanted to illustrate what it was like to be given money and to be given responsibility to manage it. And so everybody who got money last week also got a card, because we're all accountable in the same way that we're accountable to God for how we use the money that we're given. And so you'll notice in the back there's starting to be some cards appearing on this board as people write the stories of how they use the money that we gave them to honor the things that God cares about, the people that God cares about in this world. And so as the next couple weeks continue, you'll see that board continue to fill up. And if you got money, remember, you're accountable. Figure out a way to spend it on the things and the people that God cares about, and then come back and give us an account and write the story up there on the board. Today, I want to pick up where we left off last week, and I want to begin with one of the verses that we used last week and even dig in a little bit deeper. I want to talk about how we can continue taking steps away from the money-crazy culture that we live in and the money-crazy decisions that we often make, driven by our culture and driven by the presuppositions of ownership, the presuppositions that if it comes to us, it's for us, and begin seeking the freedom that Jesus says is actually possible if we simply follow the steps that he lies out, the ways that he has given us to live as it relates to our money and to our possessions. And to do that, in order to help us to take steps in that direction, I have to insult you today. I have to begin by insulting you. So last week I gave you money. This week I'm going to insult you. So it's sort of a give and take thing that's going on here. Here's the thing. And when I say I'm going to insult you, I'm going to insult us. I'm going to include me in that as well. Because there's something that all of us think we are not, but we actually are. And there's something that we think we are, but we're actually not. There's something that we think we're not that we actually are, and there's something that we think we are, but we're actually not. And I'm going to have to lift the veil and show you all that you are something you think you're not, and you are not something that you think you are. And to talk about what that is and to give you that, deliver that insult, I'm building up to it. I'm going to go back to a verse that I looked at last week, and it lays the foundation for Jesus' primary concern as it relates to money and possessions. And the verse comes from the book of Luke, one of the biographies of Jesus' life, Luke chapter 12, where Jesus tells this to the crowd before he tells them the story we looked at last week. Jesus said, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." So when it comes to money and possessions, there's a problem that Jesus is concerned with. There's a primary problem at the root that Jesus sees in the way that we think about and the way that we deal with money. And it's greed. And greed is the desire. We said this last week. Greed is the desire for a little bit more. And it's the presumption that if it comes to us, if money or possessions come to us, then it's for us. Then we earned it. It's for us. We deserve it. Somehow, that the universe has conspired to bring this good fortune to us and we should spend it on ourselves. And the desire to have just a little bit more, that we're never really fully satisfied, that is greed. And here's where I have to insult you. I have to insult us. You are greedy. And I am greedy. We are all, at some level or another, greedy. All of us have in us the desire to see the things that come to us as being for us. And we all have in us the propensity to want just a little bit more than we have. And the problem is, you probably don't think you're greedy. That's why I said I had to insult you and sort of slap you in the face and tell you, hey, you're greedy. And the reason that you probably don't think you're greedy is that unlike other vices or other character flaws that we wrestle with, greed is really difficult to see when we look in the mirror. Greed often hides behind some really, really good things. It's hard to see because it often masquerades behind virtues. So greedy people are also savers. They are concerned about saving a lot for the future. They think a lot about how much they have in savings. And saving is a really, really good thing. It's a virtuous thing. Greedy people like to control and plan and think a lot about how they manage their money. And that's a really good thing, to plan and organize and structure the way you think about your money. But sometimes that can be a way of hiding the fact that you're actually really wanting more. You're greedy. And greedy people think a lot about financial security and about their future. They worry a lot if they're going to have enough in the future. And they make decisions now based on that concern. And that's not a bad thing, to be concerned about the future. But it can be a way of hiding the greed, that desire for just a little bit more. Now, greed is really difficult to see in ourselves, but it's pretty easy to see in other people, isn't it? Isn't that funny? You're laughing because it's true. Like, we can look around in our lives and we think about people that we work with, people that we spend time around, and it's easy to see the greed in other people. Greedy people talk a lot about money. They think a lot about money. They worry a lot about money. And as a result, they talk a lot about that worry. Greedy people often talk as if they're just scraping by financially, as if they just have enough, regardless of how much they, they have, whether they have a lot or they have a little. They often present this perspective that they just barely have enough. Greedy people are often the people that you know who are discontent with the things that they have. They're always concerned about the new model of the thing or the new car or this year's new seasonal wardrobe. They're never quite satisfied with where they are and what they have. They're always thinking about what's next and what they can get next. Now, as I talked, people were probably coming to your mind that you know, people in your life. If it's the person sitting next to you, do not look at them right now. Do not nudge them. We're focused on you. This is a chance to look at yourself. Because again, greed is super easy to see in other people. It's really difficult to see when we look in the mirror. And to be clear, greed is not about income level. This is a misconception. We often think that people are greedy just because they're rich, just because they have a lot. Greed is not a financial issue. Greed is a heart issue. Greed is the thing inside of us that's never fully satisfied and always wants a little bit more and sees the things that come to us as for us. And that can be true of someone who has a lot or someone who has almost nothing. And here's the interesting thing. So there's an intrinsic relationship between the motivation of greed and the feeling of fear. Fear and greed are inextricably linked. Fear drives greed, the fear of not having enough, the fear of missing out on something. Wall Street has figured this out. There is a financial tool that you can go look up to see an index, the greed, it's called the Greed and Fear Index, and it will tell you, are investors now making decisions based on greed because market conditions are right and they're trying to take advantage of that, or are they making decisions out of fear? Are they running because they're afraid things are going to get worse? In case you're curious, all of last week, we were making decisions based on fear. Why? Because there's a lot of uncertain things going on. Trade tariffs with China, we just bombed Syria. There's a lot of uncertainty in the world. And when that happens, insecurity and fear goes up, and it sends people to make crazy decisions. But there's this linkage, too. Often fear can drive us to manifest greed in such a way that we're holding on to things or hoarding things for ourselves because we're worried about what the future is going to be like, what it's going to look like. And this is exhausting. Some of you know this. Fear leads to exhaustion. As it relates to money, fear can lead us to a place where we're worrying all the time. And it can drain us of life because we're constantly worrying about how much we have, worrying about how much we make, worrying about how much we're going to make. And that just robs us of life. It robs us of our sense of peace and our sense of security and our sense of commitment. Because you're always worried about how much you have and how much if you're going to have enough for the future. And if you feel that way today, it's okay. You're in good company because all of us, at some level or another, feel this. Because we're all, at some level or another, we're all greedy. But here's the thing. We don't have to live that way. We don't have to live in fear. We don't have to live driven by our anxiety, making decisions based on fear and greed as it relates to our money and our finances. But it's going to take a different kind of decision making. It's going to take moving away from the money crazy way of thinking that our culture and our society leads us to. And it's going to require us to make some conscious, intentional decisions to follow the way of Jesus, the crazy way of Jesus, because Jesus is crazy too. Let's don't let him slip out. He's crazy. He's just a different kind of crazy. And to follow him, you need to be a little crazy too. And that's what we're talking about in this series. And so today I want to talk about where we go from there. Where we go when we realize, when we begin to accept this idea or come to terms with this idea that maybe everything we have isn't actually all for us. And we want to begin taking steps away from this cycle of fear and greed and begin to move towards what Jesus has to say about how we experience freedom, how we experience peace and contentment as it relates to our finances. So we're going to take a look at a verse of scripture. You don't have to pull your Bible out today. It's a really short verse of scripture. It comes from the Apostle Paul, who was one of the leaders in the early church. And Paul, he was such a great entrepreneur. That would be our language for him. They called him an apostle. It was just simply a starter. He traveled all around the Mediterranean region after Jesus, after he died and was resurrected, and gave his disciples the mission to go out into the world and to spread this amazing news of the kingdom of God. Paul got on board with this, and he began traveling and teaching as he went to towns. He would tell people about Jesus, encourage them and invite them to follow Jesus, and then he would find leaders within those cities who would set up small home fellowships. This was the beginning of the church. Paul was responsible for starting a lot of the early churches, and he would travel around a lot, and as he traveled, he would also get letters back from all the places he'd been where they were asking him these questions. Like, what do we do about this? How do we deal with these real-life situations? What does it look like to follow the way of Jesus in these particular kinds of ways? And Paul would write back, and he would give them instructions. And we have a lot of those letters. One of them we're going to take a look at today. It's a letter that Paul wrote. We call it 1 Timothy. It's the first letter written to a guy named Timothy, who was a protege, one of the leaders that Paul put in charge of one of those early churches. And in this letter, Paul writes this really, really helpful section where he's giving Timothy direction about how to teach people about money and how they are supposed to live in some really practical ways. So I want to take a look at this verse, which comes out of 1 Timothy chapter 6. If you want to write that down and go back and look at it later, it's 1 Timothy 6, verses 17 and 18. Paul writes to Timothy and says, "Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous, willing to share." So Paul first tells Timothy who this message that he's sending is for. And it's for people who are rich in this present world, which means we need to pay attention, because remember, today, that's us. From the world's perspective, we are those who are rich in this present world. Compared to world standards, all of us here, regardless of how much you make, are rich. So this message is for us as well. Now he says, he gives a caution. He gives a negative caution first. He says, tell them not to be arrogant. Know anybody who's arrogant when it comes to money? Yeah, it's a funny relationship, isn't it? The more you get, often the more arrogant you become. Because here's the mistake. You think that it came to you because of you. If you believe that everything that you do is you're the one who controls your fate and your destiny, you believe you're the one who manages everything and makes everything happen, then you can become arrogant and believe that you're the owner, that it came to you because you're so special, and that can lead to arrogance. Paul says, don't do that. He says, don't be arrogant. And don't put your hope in this wealth. Don't put your hope in financial success. Why not? Because wealth is so uncertain. Wealth is uncertain. This is so true, isn't it? Some of you could stand up here today and tell your story about how uncertain money and finances are. You could tell a story about a season of your life, maybe a season of life that you're in, where you used to have a lot, and now you don't have anything. You used to be on top, and now you have very little, or how you used to have nothing, and now you're doing really well. It's the roller coaster ride of life and finances. And if you're early on in your career, early on in life, just know that wealth is uncertain, just as Paul says. We've all ridden that roller coaster ride. And so he says, don't hold on to wealth, the security of believing that somehow or another wealth is going to be what provides for you. Don't put your trust in wealth, because wealth is uncertain. And yet, isn't that our default reaction? Isn't that what we're just drawn to? We get such a sense of security. When things are going well, we feel more at ease. That's our default reaction. It's because our greed sort of leads us there. We believe if we have more, then we'll feel more secure. This is greed that drives us to want always a little bit more. And it's our fear of not having enough. It's the fear of having ridden the roller coaster and knowing what the bottom feels like, knowing what it feels like when your stomach drops out, when you go all over the hill and suddenly you go from things are going well to you don't know where your next paycheck's going to come from or how you're going to pay the bills. That elicits fear in us and leads us to want to hold on even more. Paul says, don't do that. Don't trust in riches because they're uncertain. Look what he says. What's the alternative? He says, put your trust instead of putting your trust in riches, put your trust in the one who richly provides. Don't put your trust in riches. Put your trust in the one who richly provides. Trust in God, not in money. Don't put your trust in riches, but put your trust in God, the one who richly provides. God tells us that instead of trusting in money and possessions for security, that we should trust in God. In God we trust. We should trust in God. In God we trust. That sounds familiar. If only we could put that somewhere, write it somewhere that we would remember it. Oh, wait, we already did that. I guess that's not working so well. It's sort of ironic. We've put that on our money, and yet it is our propensity to totally disregard that, to trust in the money in our hands and not in that saying, not in that idea that it is God, the one who richly provides, that we should trust in and not in our riches. So Paul tells us, don't put your trust in riches, but instead put your trust in God. But to be clear, Paul clarifies here. He also says he's not anti-things. Look what he says. Because he says, God richly provides us with everything. For what purpose? For our enjoyment. God's not anti-stuff. Paul says, God is not anti-money, not anti-possessions. It's just that there is a diminishing level of returns, that greed actually doesn't work. It doesn't actually work. God gives you everything to enjoy. But isn't it true, haven't you had this experience before, that the more you get of something, the less enjoyable it actually it is? This is a law of economics. Kevin could stand up and talk about this way, but like a PhD student in economics sitting right here is a little bit stressful as I talk about economics. But the law of diminishing marginal returns basically tells us that the more you get of something, the less enjoyable it is. And we've all had that experience, right? Like, I don't know what it is for you. I don't know whether it's cars or whether it's clothes. For me, I'm a tech guy. I love tech stuff. The first iPhone that I got was magical. Like, it was a magical device that suddenly you could touch it and it moved. It was like a computer in your hands, and it was so amazing. But here's the thing. Apple is not satisfied with me owning one iPhone, right? Like, then they're going to continue to come out with new iPhones because they want to continue to sell iPhones. And the only way for them to sell more iPhones is to make me discontent with the iPhone that I have. And so their marketing, all of their advertising, their big keynotes, they're going to tell you how awesome the new iPhone is and how terrible the old one is. And so you go and you buy the new iPhone, and it's cool. Not quite as exciting as it was the first time you got an iPhone, but it's cool. But it fades. And with each successive upgrade, now we get a new phone, it's kind of like, it's kind of the same. It's still just a phone. That's the law of diminishing marginal returns. That just tells us that greed doesn't actually work. That's the reason that Paul says, don't put your trust in riches. Don't worry about accumulating more and more, because actually it doesn't even work. This is how greed and accumulating things work. When we go from nothing to having something, it feels great. But when we get more and more of something, it's actually less and less enjoyable. But Paul says there's an alternative. Instead of trying to run on this treadmill of more and more and more and trying to get rich, Paul has a different concept. And he's using some words Jesus even talked about. Be rich. Be rich towards God. And how do we do that? We're rich towards God as we engage in doing good, being rich in good deeds, and being generous and willing to share. Now, here's where I have to insult you the second time. So you think that you're not greedy, but you actually are. And all of us think that we're generous, but we actually aren't. And here's the problem. You're arguing with me in your head right now because you're thinking about all of the times that you've given to other people, that you've given things to people. And the problem is that giving often keeps us from moving towards generosity. Giving and generosity are not the same thing. They are connected concepts, but they are not the same thing. Simply giving doesn't make you generous. Now, let me tell you what I'm talking about. To explain the difference between giving and generosity, giving, which is giving things away to people, you know, in sort of random acts of giving, is different than generosity. Here's my definition for generosity. Generosity is the joyful, purposeful, calculated, ongoing financial investment in the people and the things that God cares about. Generosity is joyful. If you're begrudgingly giving, or you do it because you think you're going to get something in return, or because it makes you feel good, you're not doing it for the joy of simply giving. If you're doing it because you feel like you have to, that God told you you have to, then you're not generous. You're just giving. That's just a random act of giving. Generosity is purposeful. It's intentional. It's thought out. It's not random. It's thought through. It's thinking through the things and the people that God care about and making a conscious decision. And then it's calculated. It's sitting down and taking the time and figuring out how much and where and when and how often. Because generosity is also ongoing. It's not one-time acts of giving. See, most of us are not generous because we're really good givers. We're good at giving. I know that you guys are good at giving. We have a very giving congregation here. But here's the thing. Sometimes giving can get in the way of becoming generous. Generous is something that we become. It's a character quality that flows out of who we are. Giving is an act, and that's different. And we're really good, our country is really good at random acts of giving. A hurricane hits, and you see a commercial on TV, text this number and give $10 to the Red Cross. Random act of giving. A friend has unexpected medical bills. You see a post online for a GoFundMe page. Here's some money. Random act of giving. Someone shows up at your door asking you to help to save the whales, the dolphins, the spotted owls, the ozone, the planet, whatever. And they make you feel guilty because they're really good. And often it's people like me who have a microphone who are really good at making you feel guilty and motivating you to give. But that's just a random act of giving. When you respond to guilt, generous people don't feel motivated by guilt because they're purposeful, they're calculated, and they're already committed to ongoing investment. They don't have to worry about people like me who often use manipulation or guilt to make people give. So random acts of giving are not bad, just to be clear. I'm pro random acts of giving. Random acts of giving are better than random acts of not giving. It's a good thing. And in our country, we're really, really good at random acts of giving. We're really good at giving a lot of away, but I don't think as a nation, we are very generous. Don't believe me? Let's look at some numbers. Listen to this. So first of all, let's start with the reality. This is the first thing that people give as an argument. America gives more away than any other country in the world. Truth. Absolutely true. But does that make us generous? Absolutely not, because when you compare the amount that we give away to the amount that we bring in, the vast majority of the money that is earned in the United States of America is spent on who? On us. So let's get personal. We'll get into, these are not perfect numbers, but we can get a picture of what this looks like from tax returns, from seeing how people do their giving and claiming deductions on their tax returns. So here's what we know from the IRS. So if people who itemize deductions and take claims for giving gifts to charitable organizations, and I get it, that doesn't count the people on the street that you give money to or friends or anything, but this gives us a picture. Of the people who itemize their taxes and make deductions, one-third of people give nothing. A third of Americans give zero to charitable organizations, which means one-third give nothing, two-thirds give something. Of the two-thirds of people that give, the average percentage of people give 2 to 3% of what they earn, which means 97 to 98% is spent on us. Does that sound generous with that definition? It doesn't sound very generous to me. It sounds like we're great givers. It sounds like we're great at giving, but it doesn't sound like we're very good at generosity. And see, this is what's interesting is that as you look at this too, you would think, some of you are sitting here and thinking, well, you know, if I made more, then I would be more generous. But actually, the numbers show the opposite. As income goes up, the percentage of giving actually goes down. The more money you make, the less generous you become. And that, you know why? Because people who have a lot of money can stroke checks that have a lot of zeros on the end, but represent a very, very small percentage of the amount of money that they earn. They look generous, and they feel generous, but they're really not. They're never going to access the kind of freedom, the kind of peace, and the kind of contentment, because greed is still driving them to hold on to most of what they have and to see it as being for them. Because if it came to them, it's for them. And so it's really hard to see this in the mirror. But when we begin to look at the percentage of what we give away to the things and the people that God cares about, we begin to see that we're actually way better at giving than we are at being generous. And again, random acts of giving, not a bad thing. I'm not trying to knock that. I'm just trying to help you to see. Some of us here today, most of us, I would say 90% of us here today, think we're generous, and we really aren't. And this is where we want to begin moving, because becoming a generous person is where we begin to access the things that Jesus promises. When we begin to open up our hands, when we begin to see that everything we have, everything we are comes from God, and we begin to see that it didn't just come to us to spend on ourselves, but we begin to think about how we can joyfully, purposefully, in a calculated and ongoing way, redirect some of that to things and people that God cares about, that's where we're going to begin. When we begin to engage in that kind of practice, that's where we begin to meet God in the middle of that, and we begin to receive the benefits of peace and contentment and joy that comes from becoming a generous person. Now, if you're here today and you consider yourself to be a follower of Jesus, you're somebody who, you believe in God, you believe in Jesus, and you've made this commitment to follow, this is the way that we have been called. This is where Jesus calls us to go as it comes to our money and our finances. And there is no place where there is greater competition for our loyalty, for our love, than when it comes to our money and our possessions. And so if you're here today and you consider yourself a follower of Jesus, this is something that we have to take a hard look at ourselves and begin to take difficult and courageous steps of moving towards becoming generous people, because that's what it looks like to have faith. That's what it looks like to believe the things that Jesus said and to do them, to try and live them out in life. Now, if you're here today and you're not a person who believes in God, not sure what you believe about Jesus, and you're still trying to figure it out, congratulations, you're off the hook. You don't have to do any of this stuff. But let me give you something to consider. See, the way I think about faith is this isn't about religious rules, or this isn't about trying to earn favor with God. There's simply one reality. There is only one truth. There is no like religious truth and secular truth. This is either true. The things that Jesus said were either true or they weren't. And here'd be my challenge to you. Just try it. You don't have to get all your questions answered. You don't have to have all your doubts resolved. Just try living your life in such a way that you would follow the way of Jesus, to open up your hands and say, maybe everything that comes to me isn't actually for me. And maybe instead of just giving stuff away randomly, I'm going to be purposeful. I'm going to be calculated in an ongoing way. I'm going to commit to redirecting some of that, because I want to see if what Jesus said is actually true. I dare you to try this. Because what I think you'll discover, regardless of what you believe about God, regardless of what you believe about Jesus, there is peace and there is freedom from the tyranny of fear and greed. And it comes as we take steps to move towards redirecting some of what's come to us, to other people. As we let go, we begin to become free from the fear and the greed that often drives us. We're all still greedy. It's a continuum. We're all a little greedy and a little generous, and we just want to keep moving towards the life and the abundant, joyful life that Jesus promises is available as we begin to do this with our money and possessions. So your homework for this week, next week we're going to come back. Don't miss next week, because we're going to get super practical. We're going to talk about how we practically can begin to do this, how we can begin to institute some practices in our daily life that'll help move us from being random givers to becoming generous, and what it looks like to begin to do that. I'm going to get super practical, so don't miss next week. But for your homework for this week is to take an honest assessment of yourself, to look in the mirror. For some of you, this should be really easy. You just did your taxes, as Adam said. This is tax day, so you should already have a picture of how much you gave away. Calculate, figure out what percentage of what's come to you have you redirected to the things and the people that God cares about, and be super generous to yourself. Overestimate the money you gave to homeless people or the things that you gave to friends, and then calculate what percentage of that, based on the net that you brought in, calculate it on the net, because taxes you pay are still paying for yourself. You may disagree with me. It's okay. You're wrong. But taxes that you pay are still benefiting yourself. Or even, heck, just calculate the percentage on the gross. Be really generous to yourself, and I think you may find you're not as generous as you think you are. And then come back next week and we'll talk about some practical ways that we can begin to move towards generosity. Now today as we close, I can't think of a better way to come to terms with this reality, this heart reality that we have inside of us, than the practice of communion. And we do this every month at this time, and so you guys can come on back up. At this point, we're going to celebrate communion together. And communion is a ritual that was instituted by Jesus. On the night before he went to the cross, he gathered with his followers for a meal. And at that meal, knowing what was ahead and knowing what he was going to do for them and for us, he gathered over dinner and he took the bread that night and he broke it. And he said, "This is my body broken for you. And do this in remembrance of me. When you gather like this in the future, do this, break this bread and remember me." And likewise, he took and he poured the cup that night and he said, this cup of wine is like my blood that's going to be poured out for the forgiveness of sins. It's a new covenant. It's a new way of being related to God. In the future, do this in remembrance of me. And as you come to the table and you break off the bread and you dip it in the juice and you take it and you remember Jesus, for those of us who've been following Jesus for a while, this is an invitation to come and to come to terms with the things in our life that are not as they should be, and to remember Jesus, and that we already have his forgiveness, that we already have his power and his enablement by the presence of the Holy Spirit in us to begin to walk this out. This isn't just self-help. This isn't just trying to gut it out and live a better way. No, Jesus does this with us, and we come to the table and we remember that. We remember him and we remember that he is with us in all of this. And if you're here today, maybe you've been coming for a little while and you're not quite sure, you haven't gotten all your doubts figured out, but you would say, "You know what, I think I believe in this Jesus, and I think I don't have all my doubts figured out, but I'm ready to start taking steps." Maybe today is the day that you mark that by coming to the table and taking communion for the first time. To just mark this day as the day that you decided to follow the way of Jesus. So as the band plays, I invite you to come. We have tables in the back. You guys, whenever you're ready, you can slip from your seats as the band plays. Break off a piece of the bread, dip it in the juice, take it, and remember Jesus.